Welcome to the Marketing Society podcast. I'm your host, Mike Piggott. And today we're going to be communicating with each other about communication, actually. And I say we because I'm joined by the wonderfully titled Head of Creative Excellence at Kantar, Lynn Deason, to talk about this. Welcome, Lynn.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Good stuff. Now, I was going to say that I was sort of diving straight into this, talking about communication on this pod. But we did a pod, I did a pod with some people at Kantar a couple of weeks ago where we talked about innovation. So I imagine we'll touch on that because obviously there's lots of overlaps with communication as well. And like the last podcast where we were using an article that you guys wrote for the Society to kind of form this chat, we're doing the same here. So you guys wrote an article around this topic. So I wanted to kind of get into that a little bit. And start with, near the top of the article, you say that great advertising drives competitive advantage and supports brand growth, but then ask readers, are they confident that their advertising will deliver? Why do you say that? What's with the confidence side of things?
Well, what we see is that marketers underestimate how important creativity is in driving the profitability that they get from the investment they make in advertising. So typically, in the survey we did, we saw that marketers ranked it as being the fourth most important criteria. And actually, after brand size, is the second most important thing. And we know that, you know, researching the consumer response to ads is key to ensuring that you're investing in creative that's going to work. But there are other benefits that I think people don't necessarily think about. So, you know, how you can optimize the ad, how you can cut it down. And knowing whether it's strategically aligned or not with the essence of your brand. So there are lots of benefits sort of beyond that effectiveness per se.
Okay. Because, I mean, one of the things I wanted to touch on was kind of, around sort of a bit of that kind of like the spray and pray effect of people just sending stuff out and kind of hoping that it has a return. Is that a thing that goes on these days more so than ever? Or, you know, are people... like you say, if communication is not that high up their agenda, is it one of these things where people just send stuff out and kind of go, okay, that's ticked off, that's sort of done, and then they try and move on to things that they consider a bit more important, perhaps?
I don't think that's necessarily true of all the content that they create, but I think the proliferation of touch points and the ease with which content can be created in a cost-effective and fast way now means that it's hard to research everything and to know if everything's going to work. So it's really important that people know what the essence of their brand is and they ensure that there's coherence across all of that content. So we think of that as glue, you know, this idea that people can glue together the different things that they encounter from the brand to create this holistic picture of what the brand's all about. I mean, there are different ways you can look at those things now. So we use AI to deal with some of that challenge. So we have a solution called Link AI, which uses machine learning to predict how effective something will be. You can look at pieces of content in context, and you can also look at optimizing content once you've deployed it. So if you have got that proliferation of content and you're desperate to know what works well in which context and, you know, how should I shift things around, then there are tools that can help you do that in a fast and cost-effective way. Mm. I think it's proliferation that's a real challenge for marketers these days.
I don't know. It sounds like it was a bit like the conversation that I had before with you guys, where we were talking about innovation, where this kind of striking a balance between being creative and then sort of forensically examining and, you know, putting something through an algorithm or through an AI to you know, completely optimize it to the nth degree. I mean, how do you kind of strike that balance? Because, I mean, I imagine most marketers came into marketing because they were kind of semi-creative people, at least. So they kind of want to keep that essence of themselves. But is it that sort of freedom within a framework? Are they still able to kind of be expressive and creative in their communications, but within sort of, you know, AI means?
Well, I think, you know, creativity is key. And, you know, that gut feel, that skill that some marketers have to identify, you know, this idea has got great potential. I really believe in it. Having that courage is really, really important. And we would definitely encourage people to do that. But at the end of the day, what matters is how your target audience will respond to that. Do they connect emotionally with it? Do they understand it in the way you intended? Is your brand integrated within it? So, you know, you're not just entertaining them with a nice piece of creative content. You're building your brand as a consequence. And there are things that happen, you know, there's this effect called knowledge bias, where marketers, they know their creative idea and how it's meant to work. And so when they see it brought to life, of course, those connections for them are blatantly obvious. But if you haven't got that prior knowledge, if you see it for the first time, it can fall down. People don't make those connections. So knowing how your audience responds because you want them really, really matters and can make a massive difference at the end of the day.
It's interesting that whole thing you say about the kind of the context or the backstory, because you get that in sort of film and TV as well, where, you know, a director will come out afterwards and say, oh, well, of course, the character was gay. And it's like, well, that wasn't on screen. Like, just because you might have like written it in a side note or something, but you're sort of retroactively kind of trying to fill in the gaps. But we don't have that knowledge. We just see what you give us.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a brilliant analogy.
I find it funny as well, because my partner's a semiotician and a cultural insight analyst expert person. So it's rubbed off on me a little bit. So whenever I see ads now, I'm just like, oh, okay, well, I can see what they're trying to do with their message, but like, what's that got to do with insurance or, you know, banking or whatever it might be? Picking on those guys, but, you know, they can take it.
Yes, I think that, you know, sounds fascinating. I'm sure someone you have wonderful, interesting conversations with. I think that understanding of the brain really matters.
I mean, one of the points is in your article where you talk about creative quality being a really important factor, and that brands that seem to have great ads are meaningfully different. And meaning came up actually in the last, I keep referring back to the last Kantar pod, but, you know, I'm trying to create this through line of consistency. But yeah, so meaning came up quite a lot. Is that something that's more important to people these days? And without being too philosophical about it, you know, has meaning always mattered with advertising, or you know, has meaning changed over the years in terms of what people consider to be meaningfully different with the end consumer with their ads?
It's a brilliant question.
Sorry, it's a triple whammy.
I think there's a risk that ads can be seen as an unwelcome disruption these days, especially when they're not tailored to the context in which they'll be experienced. So that relevance, which is another way of thinking about meaning from content, really matters. So there's a fantastic quote that I love, which is, you know, we need to stop disrupting what people are interested in and be what people are interested in. And that might lead people listening to this to think, okay, so what I say really matters. Well, yes, of course it does. But it's also how you say it and where you bring it to life that also has an impact. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that during COVID, we saw that people leaned into brands for reassurance. So that familiarity and trust and confidence that they got from brands, that meaning that they gave them, really mattered. I think as well, it's important to reflect on the fact that brands only exist in people's heads. And, you know, they're there to meet people's needs. But of course, that's only one aspect of being meaningful to people. You know, what brands mean to people goes far beyond functionality. So, you know, they might bring a benefit of status or of self-esteem. And of course, it's not just what the product does, that what it makes them feel as a consequence that marketers can tap into. So relevance really drives what people engage with. That's part of how the brain works. So it might be something that's really useful to you or someone you know and love and care about. It might be really entertaining or creative. It can be relevant from that point of view. Or people might engage with it, and this is increasingly important, from the point of view of it having a positive contribution to society or the planet in some way.
It's been an interesting playground, I suppose, maybe for want of a better phrase, with COVID at least, because it's enabled brands to really kind of lean into to being very empathetic and human, and you know, taking swings that they normally wouldn't necessarily take. And big swings tend to get rewarded, at least at the Marketing Society, with our awards. So over the years, when people have done that, and I don't know, you saw it last year where some brands had successes with that, and others kind of missed the mark. You know, it was a swing and a miss, perhaps. Yes. Do you think that the brands have sort of struggled with that kind of that relevance at the time, you know, getting meaning right?
It's a brilliant build, because we did see that there were, you know, two, maybe three groups of types of ads during COVID. And it was the ads or the brands that actively did things to help people whether it was their employees, you know, not just the customers they were trying to attract, or the NHS, you know, people that brands that engaged with COVID actively did something to make a difference that people really resonated with. So, you know, for brands like Tesco or Aldi, that was an easier thing to achieve. But a company like Heinz, for example, with their partnership with Magic Breakfast, where they ensured that children who would usually be provided with a breakfast at school, obviously they weren't going to school, so they couldn't get that. They ensured that that provision of food and nutrition, which was so important to those children, was continued. And people loved that, and they loved hearing about it.
Without getting too political about things, you mentioned sort of food and children, and you know, it just makes me think of obviously last year the things that Marcus Rashford did, but then also Burberry working with him, and they had done so before before the pandemic, and they'd been working with him for quite some time. But it was interesting to sort of see in the last few years where the government have slipped up in a certain way and brands have kind of jumped in and filled the gap. And I guess you kind of see that historically, right? With where the government of a certain age, they'll do a thing or not do a thing. And then it kind of leaves it open a bit for actually to say, you know, brands kind of stepping into a space where maybe they can support in a way that the governments can't or won't do. And I don't know, I've found that really interesting over the last few years, particularly, not just in the UK, but you see it in the US as well and other places.
Yeah, and it's what people expect, to be honest. You know, the government, you know, whatever your political view, whichever government it was, can only achieve so much. And people expect brands and businesses to lean in and actively make a difference. So that would cover things, you know, obviously like COVID, as we were just discussing, but also things like, you know, sustainability, carrying out business in a green way, but also enabling consumers to do that, making that easy for people. You know, with obesity, for example, brands can make a big difference in that space. And yes, companies are innovating, but a lot of those innovations at the moment are expensive. They come at a premium. Yet obesity is a bigger challenge in people who are deprived financially. So if you really want to tackle that issue, then businesses need to innovate and create products that are attractive to those people, but also, you know, essentially, they're also affordable.
And is it a case of sometimes the business, you know, the more affluent products or the higher priced range things where you've got people that have more money, they can kind of soak up perhaps the cost of the innovation so that you can then pass that down to, you know, your sort of lower price products that are maybe more aimed at people with obesity. I don't know if that ever works like that in businesses, or straying away from our chat of communication. But it's something that occurred to me of like, you know, it's a bit like, you know, how you tax the rich to then afford, you know, pay for social care, etc.
I don't know exactly, but I think it's frustrating for people, you know, everybody, well, not everybody, but the vast majority of people want to do something to make life better, whether that's taking care of their own well-being, whether that's, you know, looking after the climate crisis. But they need help from businesses to make that accessible. And if these things aren't affordable and effective, then, you know, they're not helping us do that. They're not helping people do the right thing that they want to do.
In a slight segue back to the article that is forming the basis of this chat, in the article you talk about three key pillars of success for ads. The first one being around understanding people and understanding audiences, if I've got that right. Mm-hmm. I guess I wanted to quickly delve into where marketers get tripped up here when they're understanding and not understanding audiences. Where do they go wrong? Are they just rushing? Are they trying to, they're getting shouted at by those above them to just put something out? Or how do you think it works these days?
I think the pace in which content gets created now, or the demands for the speed with which it gets created, is problematic. So I think that puts pressure on businesses being able to, or feeling they can't invest enough in understanding the audience. I think generally, you know, there's a decline in the recognition of the importance of that. And it's easy for anybody to think, oh, well, people are like me, but that's a very dangerous assumption. You know, and ads that are effective do that really, really well. So let's think of some examples. If we think about Christmas and the Tesco ad, you know, which tapped into those little guilts, those things that we'd all done wrong, you know, during COVID. And it did that in a really humorous way, but it did that in lots of different ways, in a way that connected with lots of different audiences. Heineken with cheers to whatever you ordered. So that's where you see, you know, people in a bar or in a restaurant, and there might be a woman and a man together, and the man will be given Heineken and the woman will be given a cocktail, because there's that assumption.
Okay. Yeah. So they were challenging sort of stereotype, gender stereotypes a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
But the human insight around that, you know, it wasn't just that insight, which might feel like it's quite an obvious thing, but the way it was executed really made connections with people, you know, regardless of their gender. We've been looking recently at the Walker's Crisps In, Crisps Out ad. Okay. And the insight in that wasn't just that some people put their crisps in sandwiches, you know, which is quite interesting. But what made it interesting was the tension, you know, that people who do this have a bit of shame about it. You know, they're embarrassed that they put their crisps in their sandwiches. And equally, if you sit on the other side of the fence, people who don't do that tend to hate it. So it was that tension that was really interesting. And the marketer behind this, Fernando Cahane, he's Brazilian by origin. And so he worked particularly hard to understand this insight and also the sense of British humour.
I was going to say, I imagine I've been to Brazil. I didn't remember seeing anyone eating crisp sandwiches.
No, it's quite a British thing, I believe. And I think our obsession with eating crisps alongside a sandwich is also quite a British thing. But I found it fascinating. I thought it was a really good inspiration for other marketers, that he put in extra effort to make sure he understood the audience, because he couldn't bring that himself from his own experiences necessarily. So he worked extra hard with the insight team. And I think as a consequence, you know, what they created was really positive.
One of the going back to the pillars in the article again, I want to just jump ahead of team. I was sort of jumping around, but with the final pillar, we've talked about this briefly a couple of times already, but it's about developing a powerful and authentic idea and committing to it. And I just wanted to get a sense of kind of where marketers get tripped up here, you know, in terms of committing to an idea. Is it getting the whole business on board? Does it start at the top? Again, actually, this sort of echoes the previous podcast with you guys around innovation, of trying to get, you know, ideas seen through. I'm just curious, like, how that works within, particularly within communication.
I think this is really, really important, and increasingly so, given the proliferation of connection points, as we were saying earlier. I think it's tempting when you arrive in a new role, you know, you want to have an impact. And so, of course, it's tempting to change the creative idea because it feels like it's a very visible way for you to achieve that. But we know that repetition is really important. So as I was saying earlier, you know, brands exist in people's heads, and you've got to repeat that consistently to build that clarity of what your brand is all about. And that can be quite an emotive thing, as you know, as we were saying, it's not necessarily all about functionality. And familiarity with an idea makes it easier for the brain to engage with it. So, you know, our lazy brains, it's easy to engage with something you're familiar with. And it can also make it easier to know which brand it's from. And it allows you to build those brand cues that can help your brand come to mind easily, you know, when a relevant need or usage occasion arises. I think what it also does is it unifies the business behind a common goal. So having a consistent creative platform, you know, often distilled into a single thought or an idea that everybody internally can grasp in their heads, really helps everyone deliver the brand promise and the essence of the brand consistently. Now, this isn't just about communications. Every encounter with a brand should live up to that promise, to those expectations, you know, whether it's experience or if it's the packaging. So I think it also has that internal benefit. So the brand shows up in an authentic way on as many occasions as possible.
Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. I've mentioned this a few times on various podcasts about Steve Ratcliffe's leadership mantra: future, engage, deliver. And again, it sounds applicable here, where you know you have your future, that your vision that everybody's going to buy into, and then everyone engages, has to engage with it, and then you deliver it, and you have to kind of do those three things in that order, and you can't skip any. Otherwise, it doesn't work, because obviously if your whole business aren't engaging with what you're doing, then they're not going to deliver it. But yeah, I guess that's the hardest to do, right? Is kind of, you know, have a vision that everybody's going to buy into from the off. And then yeah, that getting them all engaged in it is probably, depending on how many departments and red tape and different types of things you have to jump through, it's kind of interesting. So I'm always impressed when any size, but particularly a large size organization, puts out some kind of really coherent campaign that's kind of across loads of different mediums in loads of kind of playful and exciting ways. Mm-hmm. Mostly because I'm just thinking about all the internal things that they must have had to go through to kind of make that happen. So yeah, occasionally when I've spoken to different CMOs and marketing directors, it's always sort of interesting. You know, you get like a little wry smile or something like that, and you just think, oh, I'm curious about the story behind that.
Yes. Yeah. It's that uniting people is so important. And it makes a difference to people's motivation. You know, if they buy into what the brand is all about, they feel more motivated. And so they deliver better work as a consequence. It makes it a better place to work.
Well, just glancing at the time, we're running out of time a little bit. So I just want to round up our chat by talking about the final thing near the end of the article. You mentioned kind of music enhancing sort of emotional reactions. We did have an article on the Society site a few years ago about the best way marketers can use music and sort of avoid getting into certain traps in terms of music rights and things as well. But yeah, it had lots of kind of tips in that space. And I just kind of want to find out, you know, how easy or hard is it for marketers to use music? And do they think about it as maybe as much as they should do? Because, you know, I think about all the best directors out there that tend to be known for using music in a really punchy, powerful ways. You know, no matter what you might think of Tarantino, he's a great example of that. So is Edgar Wright as well. And I'm just sort of curious, kind of, are there any tips that you can give marketers in terms of using music more effectively, or thinking about baking it into the process, or even leading with it as part of their initial idea?
Well, I think we could do a whole podcast.
Probably right. And I'm just finishing with this question.
I think I completely agree with you. I think the way you've spoken about it in terms of, you know, thinking about the equivalent in cinema, you know, it guides the whole emotional experience. It influences whether you think a piece of content is relevant to you or not. All those things apply to advertising. And you only have to think about how important it is by reflecting on the impact that music can have on us as human beings. You know, it affects how fast we can run. So the right music can help you run 15% faster. It can bring back memories in people with dementia. It can help stroke victims regain speech. So there's this deep impact that music has on our physiology, how we interpret what we're experiencing, and the same applies with advertising. So the Heineken ad that we talked about earlier, the track on that is You Don't Own Me, which makes it lighthearted. So the words within that implicitly help you interpret what you're seeing in terms of the creative. It's upbeat, it's fun. So, you know, they could have chosen a different track and had a very different response. You know, we looked at a car ad, exactly the same visuals, but a different track. And the idea was that people were desperate to drive this car because they loved it so much. One track was Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better.
Okay.
And this was a French car. And the other track was Moi Je Joue, which you won't know. And I would imagine when I say that, but it was fun, lighthearted. You know, Moi Je Joue is about being playful. People interpreted the visuals totally differently. So Moi Je Joue, it was like they were having fun together, this couple, you know, deciding who was going to drive the car. It was an enjoyable thing. They were playing. Anything you can do, I can do better. They were arguing. You know, I want the car. No, you can drive the car. And it was just the music. That was all it was that made the difference. So I'd say, as you said in your intro, don't underestimate how important it is, how key it is to triggering emotion. You need to get it right.
I feel like it should be sort of required homework for a lot of marketers to listen and watch interviews with certain directors and how they talked about how they created a certain, not directors, sorry, film composers, and how they created certain moments. There's lots of really interesting interviews with like Howard Shore, Hans Zimmer, people like that. And I think it's Spielberg actually once said that if he wasn't a director, he'd be a composer. That's what he would want to be. because it's kind of, for him, it's just this such purely creative thing linked to human emotion. I do feel like people just forget about it a little bit and then slap a track on it at the end or something obvious or whatever, they can get signed off. And it's just, for me, yeah, it's so important. And I don't know, obviously I don't need to sell it to you, but
tragic, isn't it, to do that. And something we encourage the team at Cantor to do when they're looking at how people have responded to a piece of creative is to just experience it with your eyes closed. So just listen to the audio, because there can be subtle things in there that otherwise you miss and you don't hear. And we're not necessarily conscious of the fact that we're responding to those. But unless you just listen to the audio, the visuals are, you know, a big distraction, you miss out on that. So I think something that the marketers can also do.
Well, that sounds a really good point on which to end the chat. But I just want to say lots of fascinating stuff in there. And if there's anything interesting that you want to point people to, we can link some things. We can put those in the show notes. But for now, Lynn, thank you so much for coming on the Marketing Society podcast.
Many thanks, Mike. Really enjoyable conversation.